Welcome back to Robbinsdale Revisited, the show where we dust off old newspaper clippings, dig up forgotten neighborhood lore, and explore the wild history right under our feet. I'm Crystal Boyd, a loyal, dues-paying member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
And I'm Pete Ritchie, the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Crystal, if you walk over to Welcome Park today, you'll see some kids playing, baseball games, green grass, and families out for a stroll. But if we traveled back about 100 years to that exact same spot, what would we hear?
You would hear the roar of single-engine Curtis Jennies and the smell of aviation fuel and see thousands of spectators watching daredevils jump out of airplanes.
That's right. From 1919 until just after World War II, that area, stretching from Douglas to West Broadway and north of 46th, was the famous Robbinsdale Airport.
Back in the 1920s, we're talking about world record endurance flights, home-built kit planes, and some of the most wildly daring women you've ever heard of. Today, we're spotlighting the bold individuals, especially the fear-defying women, and taking a deep dive into how this little grass airfield served the country in the 1940s before giving birth to today's Crystal Airport.
Okay, strap in because we're taking off. To understand the Robbinsdale Airport, you have to picture what aviation was like in the early 1920s. It was the Wild West of the sky. Planes didn't have brakes, carburetors would slop gasoline everywhere on bumpy runways, and half the time the pilots were taking off on prayers and pure grit.
And one of the founding fathers of that wild scene right here in Robbinsdale was pioneer pilot Walter Bullock. Bullock witnessed one of Minnesota's first airmail flights in 1911 when he was a small boy at what was then known as Lake Calhoun. Then he got his pilot license in Virginia in 1916, and he helped start the Robbinsdale Airport back in 1920 when it was still just an open farm field.
And Bullock was a legendary character. He flew part-time for Captain Billy Fawcett, the famous Robbinsdale publisher of whiz-bang fame. In fact, in 1924, Bullock was the pilot of the Fawcett seaplane when it pulled Ralph Samuelson, the inventor of water skiing, across Lake Pepin at a blistering 80 miles an hour on a homemade water ski.
And I didn't know this. This is amazing. So a shout out to the Lake City Historical Society that helps to preserve that history of water skiing. They still have an annual festival. You can go every year down to Lake City and celebrate. And when you go, you can think about this Robbinsdale connection. Because I just can't imagine being dragged across a lake behind an airplane at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah, and if you hit that lake at 80 miles an hour, it would have felt like concrete. I mean, it's just wildly dangerous, all this stuff.
People were amazing, doing all sorts of interesting recreational things in the 1920s. But through all that, Bullock was the man who actually taught local legend Gene Shank how to fly in the Fawcett Seagull back in 1924.
So speaking of Captain Billy Fawcett, in 1928, he teamed up with a naval architect, Weston Farmer, to launch a brand new magazine out of Robbinsdale called Modern Mechanics. Eventually, they got sued by Popular Mechanics, so they had to change the name a little bit. It was Mechanics with an X for a while. It became Mechanics Illustrated, and I think it even went through another name change.
And they had a big pitch to their readers. One of them was how to build and fly your own airplane. Right here in Robbinsdale, they published plans for home-built light planes like the tiny Ed Heath Parasol.
Crystal, these planes were tiny. The propeller hub came up to about a grown man's belt buckle. And when you sat in the cockpit, you would reach over to the side and touch the grass. When the planes took off, the spinning prop would chew up so many grasshoppers that the goggles were completely plastered in bug goo.
It's disgusting and amazing. But testing these experimental angel maker planes was Gene Shank, who went on to hold a world record for performing 569 consecutive loop-the-loops.
On one test flight over Robbinsdale in a water-cooled Model A-powered plane, the ship was so tail-heavy that Shank literally climbed out of the back cockpit and climbed into the front cockpit, airborne at 500 feet, just to level the plane out so he could land it safely. So reading from the Minneapolis Star, Saturday, May 28th in 1921, plane spills in lake, belt holds pilot, veteran flyer pinned in water, has a narrow escape. Homer F. Cole, flyer for the Ashley Airplane Corporation and former captain in the British Air Force, miraculously escaped death early this morning when his airplane, flying at 100 miles per hour, fell into Crystal Lake in Robbinsdale. Cole had twice circled the lake and did not realize how close to the water he was flying. When, on the north end of the lake, his machine struck the surface, turning completely over and pinned him underneath the water. The sudden force of the crash stunned Cole for a moment, but he regained his presence of mind and attempted to extricate himself from the life belt which fastened him to the pilot seat. The belt slipped, causing the buckle to catch, and it took 2 more minutes before he could loosen the belt. He climbed upon the wing and was rescued by summer residents who came out in nightshirts and pajamas to assist with the rescue work. Cole escaped practically uninjured, and the machine, which fell in 40 feet of water, was damaged only slightly. The plane was towed to the beach near Crystal Lake Bathhouse and brought ashore by means of a tackle squad number 1 of the Minneapolis Fire Department, led by Captain Edward Ulhein, which responded to the emergency call, assisted by lake residents, brought the airplane ashore. Cole, who was stationed at Ashley Flying Field at Robbinsdale, took to the air shortly before 5 a.m. this morning and flying directly to Crystal Lake. He was testing the machine at the time, preparing to fly to Brainerd, Minnesota, for an exhibition flying trip. The accident, he said, will not interfere with his plans for the trip. The accident happened because he did not realize how close he was to the water and not any engine or other trouble. Water is very deceptive from the air, Cole said. Trees along the lake shore also confused me, and I thought I was flying at least 10 feet above the water when the machine struck. I was stunned by the crash, but instinctively I knew what had happened, and at once tried to unloosen the life belt, but it was stuck. Cole served as a pilot in the British Air Force overseas for nearly 5 years. He has never been in a serious crash, although he bears a scar on his nose as a result of a bullet wound sustained in an air battle in France. He has been flying for the Ashley Corporation for 2 years. The airplane which Cole drove was a Curtiss JN-4 machine equipped with a 90-horsepower engine. The only damage to the machine was a broken prop and a large hole in the upper left wing. The crash of the machine into the lake awoke several residents along the lake shore. Floyd Nash, owner of Crystal Lake Bathhouse, Howard Tumble, lifeguard, and H.A. Morris and J.H. Johnson of Robbinsdale, rescued Cole and towed the plane close to the shore.
Yeah. I don't know the year for this little clipping, but it's called You Can't Have Air Council Sans Council, Can You? Well, plane flies away without alderman, caught in chase, blame photographer. The first aerial council meeting to be conducted in the state cannot be an aerial council meeting if the councilmen are left behind and don't get to the council meeting. So the first attempt of the Robbinsdale Council to inaugurate the Robbinsdale Air Patrol was a flivver, and all because a photographer wanted to take a picture of the air-minded council. W.S. Randall, mayor of Robbinsdale, and Oscar Dahl, W.T. McKenzie, and William Wandel, councilman, together with Gene Shank, president of the Shank Flying Service and Robbinsdale Air Patrol chief, took their places in the plane for the inaugural flight, which was scheduled to continue for 1 hour. Shank took his place in the pilot's seat, and the city officials were seated in the cabin. Everything was ready. A cameraman then appeared and asked the mayor and the council to kindly step to the ground to be photographed. They obliged. The cabin door was closed behind them for a proper background. But then, a student pilot at the airport was waving a goodbye to one of the fairer sex, and Shank took the message as a signal to give her the gun. He did. The meeting place was in the air. The councilmen were on the ground. So a big blackboard was hastily found, and the words, "Council not with you," were printed on it. A second ship, piloted by Harry Hemper and Arnold Anderson, took off and chased Shank downtown before they were able to fly across the chief's nose and impart the message that the first meeting was delayed because of a lack of quorum. Shank returned to his home port, and the council was then securely locked in the cabin, and the first aerial council was conducted over the village of Robbinsdale. A resolution commenting on the success of an aerial patrol was adopted, and a motion to continue the service was passed.
Yeah, and I remember reading about this in some other articles. The idea was you would have an air police, and they would be up there flying over Highway 52, and if you were speeding, they would be able to report you. So it was an air patrol for the little police department, so that Robbinsdale could be even more of a speed trap. I didn't know that the council decided to have a meeting on an airplane because it would be a novelty, another way to promote the airport and make the papers, and too bad Shenka left him on the ground.
Now, Pete, early aviation wasn't just a boys' club. Robbinsdale became legendary for its daring women, the pioneer skydivers and female pilots of the era.
And we have to talk about Jean Durand. In the newspapers, she was hailed as the 19-year-old Robbinsdale aviatrix. Jean was an absolute sensation.
In May of 1929, right here at the Robbinsdale Flying Field, Jean Durand set out to break the world record for high-altitude parachute jumping for women. The other Jean Shank, was piloting her plane. They climbed for over an hour through a raging snowstorm in May, raging snowstorm, and the ground was completely lost. They couldn't see it at all.
Yep, up there, double Jeans in the airplane. At 18,700 feet, Shank's instruments literally froze solid, and he kept climbing up by feel for another 500 to 700 feet, reaching over 19,000 feet high. Up in the freezing sky, young Jean Durand put on her goggles, stepped out onto the plane's wing, and leaped into the abyss with her polka dot tie flapping behind her in the wind.
It took her a solid 15 minutes to zip back down to Earth. She was heavily clothed but thoroughly chilled when she touched down just 3 blocks away from the Robbinsdale runway. When she landed, she casually chatted with the gasping crowd and said, "I didn't mind it a bit. For me, it's almost as easy as falling off a log."
Yeah, falling off a log or falling out of bed, it's all the same, from 19,000 feet in freezing weather. What a legend. But parachute jumping back then was incredibly perilous, and not every jump went smoothly.
Right. Take 19-year-old Frances Clark in August of 1927. She had answered a newspaper ad looking for volunteer jumpers. On her very first jump over Robbinsdale, 10,000 breathless spectators watched in horror as she pulled the wrong release rope. The knot tightened, leaving her dangling helplessly beneath the plane's wing as Jean Shank circled the field.
A passenger on board, Earl Henning, climbed out onto the wing and cut the rope. But the knot snagged on a wing strut. It finally slipped free a half mile north, but strong winds blew Frances straight into the middle of Twin Lake.
And she couldn't swim. So, as her heavy parachute pulled her under the water for a third time, three local fishermen rowed over and pulled her out just in the nick of time. And do you know what Frances said the moment she caught her breath in the bottom of the rowboat?
No, what did she say?
She weakly murmured, "Gee, it was fun. I'm going to try it again next Sunday."
Yeah, but Frances Clark tragically lost her life in a jump later that year in Alexandria. But at her funeral, Robbinsdale Flyers honored her memory by flying a plane over the cemetery and showering her grave with flowers dropped from the sky.
Another remarkable woman whose story is tied to our local field was Harriet Frost. Harriet was 39 years old in September of 1937. She was a dynamic executive. She was the vice president and general manager of the Frost Paint and Oil Company in Minneapolis. She was also an artist, a figure skater, a horsewoman, and a local leader who lived right on Unity Avenue in Robbinsdale.
And Harriet fell in love with aviation after taking commercial flights for business. She took up flying as a hobby to unwind, taking lessons at Robbinsdale Airport twice a week. She had even started soloing and was planning to buy her own plane.
On September 5th, 1937, Harriet went up for a flight with her instructor, Glenn Chase. Shortly after takeoff, at just 200 feet off the ground, the plane entered a sudden spin and crashed onto the roof of a residence on Jefferson Highway, just a block north of the airfield. Both Harriet and Glenn perished.
And it was a tragic loss, but Harriet remains an inspiring pioneer, a prominent businesswoman, and a local aviatrix who pursued the open skies with incredible passion. This incident made the papers, and one of the saddest things is the plane crashes into a house. They had to climb up onto the second story and up onto the roof of the front porch to get them out. And there's these photos in the paper that you just don't see anymore where they have a priest saying the last rites over the bodies. Yeah, that whole speed graphic era, it's very different.
When pilots weren't dodging trouble in the sky, they spent their off hours right across West Broadway at Ellis's Log Cabin Restaurant. It started as a chicken shack in the 1920s and became the premier hangout for local aviators. That building later became Steve-O's Bar and is still standing today.
And we can't forget the famous 00 Club. It was an informal association formed by local pilots who wanted to have fun when the weather was 00, meaning zero ceiling and zero visibility. Their official ditty went, "When the skies are fair, we take to the air with one firm hand on the throttle. When the day is over, we land in the clover and transfer our hand to the bottle."
As the 1930s drew to a close, the era of relaxed barnstorming came to an end. When World War II broke out in the early 1940s, civilian aviation across the country was mobilized for defense. Robbinsdale Airport stepped up in a massive way.
That's right. In 1942, under the leadership of airport manager and squadron leader, Captain Harry Holcomb, the Robbinsdale Airport became a key base for Minnesota's Civil Air Patrol, or CAP, part of the State Guard.
This was a unit of 45 dedicated local volunteers, including 30 civilian pilots and 25 ground crew members. So who were these people? They were just local mechanics, teachers, storekeepers, bakers, just everyday residents. And remarkably, 4 of Robbinsdale's Civil Air Patrol pilots were women.
Yeah, and we've got some great old pictures of these folks all standing at the airport in their uniform. And for some reason, they couldn't find women's uniforms. So all of the women look like they're wearing these uniforms that just don't fit them. The pants are too long. The shirts are too baggy. It's a great sight. These volunteers provided their own planes, fuel, and time without receiving a single dime of compensation. They flew 23 two-seater Piper Cubs, light 50 to 75 horsepower aircraft. Because these little planes could fly as slow as 60 miles an hour, they were ideal for scouting and hedgehopping.
In 1942, these men and women were rushed through an intense 230-hour ground school course hosted by the Elks Club in downtown Minneapolis. They spent late nights studying aerial photography, radio operations, and telegraphy. They also studied Morse code, military drill, and emergency first aid.
Yep, and outfitted in khaki uniforms and overseas caps, field glasses, and maps, they spent their weekends formation flying, patrolling defense lines, carrying messages, and scanning the skies over Hennepin County for, I don't know, enemy Japanese or German aircraft.
Maybe they hadn't been noticed yet. As crucial as the airfield was during the war, the world around it was changing rapidly. Robbinsdale experienced a massive post-war building boom. What was once open farmland in the 1920s was suddenly surrounded by cozy suburban residential neighborhoods.
Yeah, safety concerns began mounting in October of 1944. Fire struck the airport, destroying hangars before local bucket brigades brought it under control. Then, in January 1945, as World War II was nearing its end, the Minnesota Department of Aeronautics officially refused to relicense the Robbinsdale Airport, citing its dangerous proximity to residential housing.
Civilian flying at the historic Grass Field was officially ordered to shut down, but the local aviation community wasn't about to disappear.
State's flying service, led by Harry Holcomb, immediately looked north. In October of 1946, the Metropolitan Airports Commission and Crystal Village approved a brand new 100-acre site just 1 mile north of the old Robbinsdale Field.
Residents in Crystal actually viewed the new airfield as a major community asset. Holcomb moved his operations, flight school, and repair shops north, and the Civil Air Patrol Squadron relocated right alongside him.
The 100-acre field became the modern Crystal Airport, KMIC, which remains a bustling general aviation airport to this day. Meanwhile, the original Robbinsdale runway was redeveloped, and today Welcome Park stands right where the brave pilots once took off.
And Pete, I think you know someone who used to fly out of there.
Our resident curmudgeon and longtime board member, Raleigh Haywood, had more airport stories than anybody else. He spent some time out there actually building his own aircraft, sanding down the balsam wood on these wings and painting it to make it just perfect. And he used to love to tell the story of how he helped fly the last couple planes out of the airport and over to the new Crystal Airport. And he just had so many great stories. There was a guy named Charles Weber. His son later served on the school board in Robbinsdale for many years. Charles Weber had brought airplanes out to the airport really for inspection, military aircraft. And there's all these pictures of those two out there at the airport in the freezing cold looking over these fighter planes from World War II. Raleigh had this map of the Robbinsdale Airport that showed it and gave it its designation and everything. And he always insisted that it was displayed prominently in the museum because he loved to tell people stories about his days out at the airport. And there are so many. I mean, there's stories we're missing here. The airport had quite a few hangar fires over the years. There was one in the 1920s. There was another one in the 1930s. You know, these planes just slopped gasoline everywhere and everybody smoked. So they had lots of problems with that. And we mentioned a couple women parachuters. There was a lot of different barnstorming activities there. They would do things like fly a plane through a barn, open up one side and out the other side. And there's some pictures of an airplane. They found a house that was going to be abandoned and they decided to fly a plane through a house and pretty much destroyed it on the way through. I don't know how it didn't destroy the airplane or how anybody survived that. Skydiving, wing walking, and these events, thousands of people would show up at the Robbinsdale Airport and crane their necks upward and see what the planes were doing.
People were so creative.
Yeah. There was Walter Bullock also famously crashed his plane into Crystal Lake, got out, and I'm afraid he was still drunk, and then decided to get into a car and drive, and he got pulled over for drunk driving the same day that he crashed his plane into Crystal Lake.
That's got to be some kind of record, both drunk flying and so driving.
Just a little bit of scratching, and you can always find a story about the Robbinsdale Airport. They made themselves famous, too, by being in Captain Billy's Modern Mechanics. There was sort of a column once a month about the goings-on at the airport. You know, who was building a plane, who was doing tricks and the other crazy ideas. You know, could a plane mow a lawn? Could you have some sort of polo game with automobiles and airplanes, you know? Take just a moment. A lot of old timers in Robbinsdale remember the Chase Family Restaurant, which was over here on West Broadway. And Sam Chase was kind of the cook. His dad owned the restaurant. He was just a townie. Everybody knew him and he was busy up and down Main Street, but he was also out at the Robbinsdale Airport every weekend flying planes. Sadly, he was flying from here to Fridley when his plane crashed in Fridley and he perished in that accident. Just another example of how dangerous this actually was to go build your own plane and then fly it around. Dave Dover went from the Robbinsdale Airport to become a flyer in World War II, came back from the war and got very involved in aviation and engineering. Gene Shank, we should mention, was one of Northwest Airlines' early pilots, and he unfortunately perished in a plane crash. Walter Bullock lived to a very ripe old age and continued to build planes in his garage and got himself in some trouble because he would fly these ultralight planes around downtown Minneapolis without any permission.
What a character. They sound like quite a crew. It's incredible to realize that when you stand in Welcome Park today, you are standing on the exact ground where early aviation history was forged.
From pioneers like Walter Bullock to the wild barnstormers and high-flying aviatrixes of the 1920s to the home-built kit planes of modern mechanics and the brave Civil Air Patrol volunteers of World War II, Robbinsdale laid the groundwork for everything that followed at Crystal Airport.
So next time you drive past Steve-O's or hear a small plane passing overhead from Crystal Airport, take a moment to look up. Think of Jean Durand floating down from 19,000 feet, Harriet Frost chasing her passion for the sky, and the volunteers who patrolled our local borders.
That's the spirit of Robbinsdale Revisited. Fly, Robin, fly. I'm trying to think of how the disco song went.
Fly, Robin, fly.
Yes. Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one. City every Saturday to see our friends. In the bus back home, sitting hand in hand. When the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah. And from Captain Billy's Whiz Bang magazine from August of 1920, we have a little joke. Captain Billy, why do airplanes always have such good manners?
Because they always keep their nose up and their tail down.